open the Senate Revenue Committee. We will follow the order today and do 3051 first, and then House Bill 2166 second. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3051. Lizette.
Chairman Deckard and committee members, with House Bill 3051A, I'm going to just start by giving you some background, so I've kind of given you just a quick summary here of current law of this particular issue, since it is kind of a complicated issue. I think I'll just start in with some of the background and then go into some of the details about 3051A and how we got where we are. To begin with, this is dealing with the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association, the OIGA assessments, and also the interaction then between these OIGA assessments and the fire insurance premium tax offsets. So to begin with, under current law, we have the fire insurance premium tax, and this is a credit also for this tax that is paid. And basically, this fire insurance premium tax is on insurance companies and is dedicated to the state fire marshal's office. And it is assessed at 1% of the gross fire insurance premiums. Now, in addition to this fire insurance premium tax credit, you also have the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association, the OIGA tax credit. Now, what this is that the corporate excise tax has been assessed on the income of insurance companies, and there are two specific then corporate excise tax credits that are allowed under current law. And these are for the property and casualty insurers to recoup the taxes that they pay. So to begin with, for insurers who pay both the corporate excise tax as well as the fire insurance premium tax, they are allowed then an excise tax credit for that gross fire insurance premium tax that is paid. And then also under current law, for those insurers who pay both the corporate excise tax as well as an assessment on the OIGA to cover then the cost of claims against insurers who have gone out of business, they are allowed an excise tax credit for assessments paid to the OIGA. And again, this particular tax credit is taken then 20% each year for 5 years of that total assessment that is assessed for the insurance companies. Now, with the OIGA, basically the insurers claim on their corporate excise tax credit, they first claim the fire insurance premium tax credit as their first tax credit, and then they take what is remaining of their tax liability and they use the OIGA credit second on their corporate excise taxes. And this is critical to understand because this then determines some of the interaction that goes on under current law, because the remaining OIGA assessments that are not claimed as a corporate excise tax credit can be used as an offset on the gross fire insurance premium tax that is paid. So that's kind of the connection then, is that you've got two different tax credits, and one of the taxes, the fire insurance premium tax, is also used as an offset then for the OIGA assessment. Now, one other component to just recognize that we have under current law is a retaliatory tax. And this applies to foreign insurers that are doing business in Oregon. So they have a different state as their home state. And this retaliatory tax is calculated then as the difference between the taxes and fees that would have been paid in the insurer's home state. So say like the insurer's home state is Washington State, you would total up the amount of taxes that they would be paying in the home state of Washington State, and comparing that then with the taxes and fees that insurance companies actually pay here in Oregon. Then if there is a difference there in terms of the home state assessing a higher tax than Oregon taxes, then you would see then a positive retaliatory tax, where that would be something that would be in effect. And what we've seen there isn't any specific data on this, but from just general discussions is that most states impose higher insurance taxes than Oregon, so the retaliatory tax here in Oregon is positive for most out-of-state companies. Now, just so you're clear on this retaliatory tax, the fire insurance premium tax is one of the components then of this retaliatory tax. But the corporate excise tax credits are not, and that is because they're looking at the total taxes, not taking into consideration any credits that are allowed by the insurance companies here in Oregon. So since those corporate excise tax credits are not a component of the taxes and fees that are assessed here in Oregon, then what we see when we see the impact of House Bill 3051, that basically is not having an effect on the retaliatory tax. And also, these taxes are the taxes that are assessed by the state, not by the private insurer. So with House Bill 3051A, what we're seeing is increase in the premium, at the increase in a tax or assessment on the premiums, but that's going to go to the private insurers, not to the state itself. If we had a new premium assessment that was going to be going to the state general fund, then it would be having an effect on the retaliatory tax. But the way House Bill 3051A is written, this is going to be a new assessment on the premiums, but the insurance companies will retain that assessment, and so it's not having an effect on retaliatory tax. So I just wanted to make sure everyone was clear, because that's all kind of a component of our existing law in dealing with insurance companies. So basically, the tax revenue that are some of the concerns that are generated, House Bill 3051A, under current law, is what we're seeing is these OIGA assessments have increased dramatically due to these large claims, basically from September 11th disaster. Prior to the 2001 disaster, that basically the largest assessment that, just looking at the data from 1992 had an assessment of like $1.1 million on Oregon insurance property and casualty insurance company. So, you know, now what we're seeing is in 2001 we had a total assessment there of $15 million in 2001, $12 million in 2002, and $11 million in 2003, and it's estimated another $5 million in 2004. In 05, it's estimated at about $1 million, and then it's declining again to kind of some normal levels in 2006-08 as far as the amounts that's forecasted of these OIGA assessments. But recognize this is really what's triggering some of the concern in 3051A and the reason why we're looking at a policy change. Now, again, what you're also seeing in recent years is because these insurance companies have such large losses, and that's the reason why we're having such high OIGA assessments is due to losses and companies going out of business, then what you see is the corporate taxable income for these property and casualty insurance companies has fallen. Between 2000 and 01, in 2000, the net tax for those the corporate tax that they paid was $10 million versus $4.4 million in 2001. So we've seen a dramatic fall in the corporate income tax that they have before credits. So then the other issue then is that when you have this corporate income tax falling, then the OIGA assessments and the amount that can be claimed there that assessment does not get fully recouped through the corporate tax system. So then the insurance companies would turn to their gross fire premium tax as then the mechanism in which they would offset and recoup some of these OIGA assessments. And so that's what then is causing the fire marshal fund to decline also, and it's projected to have shortfalls from the amount of fire premium insurance tax that could be collected if they didn't have these offsets and the OIGA assessments weren't so large. So that's what you've got is two components here. You've got the OIGA assessments that are quite large, and then you've got the corporate taxable income that has been falling for these corporations, which then results in lower general fund revenue. So what we're seeing is that the general fund is being reduced from both the corporate excise tax credit, the OIGA assessments is larger, as well as the state fire marshal fund then is also being reduced in the amount of tax that can be generated there from the OIGA assessments. So what is House Bill 3051A then? What is it doing and how is it dealing with this problem? First of all, it's eliminating the corporate excise tax credit and the fire insurance premium tax offset for the OIDA assessment. So basically, it's not using then the, you know, general fund and the state fire marshal fund as a way in which you're going to get, the insurance companies will get recouped for their OIDA assessments that they're paying. What it's doing then is providing authorization for insurance companies to impose a new assessment on fire insurance premiums that will collect, that they will collect. They will keep this new assessment themselves in order to recoup their costs for the OIDA assessments. So each year they will be anticipating what is going to be their total OIDA assessments, and then they will calculate a new assessment on the premiums given the amount of premiums that they have sold here in Oregon, and they will be assessing a new assessment in order to cover those OIDA assessments. So there won't be any of this recouping through the corporate tax system or through the fire marshal fund through that fire premium insurance tax. And then what we're seeing is this applies to recoupment of OIDA assessments imposed on or after January 1st, 2003, as well as OIDA assessments imposed prior to January 1st, 2003 that have not been fully recouped. So this really gets back to, you see, in 2001 is when we first started with really quite large OIDA assessments. So there may be some that didn't get recouped by insurance companies in 2001 and 2002 that we would also be allowing to be recoup through new assessment on the premium. It is also, the bill also provides DCBS with rulemaking authority to establish a minimum threshold for which a recoupment assessment can be imposed. And this is really, I mean, this could have a revenue impact, but according to DCBS, the way they're reading this is it's not going to, the threshold's going to be real small. So this, we're just assuming in this analysis that it really will have a negligible revenue impact on this. So then with House Bill 3051A, I just wanted to point out some of the main revenue impact components and then some of the assumptions that are pretty key in this. To begin with the tax revenue impact, you have the two components, one being the corporate excise tax revenue increase because you're eliminating that credit, and that would be to the general fund, and then you also have an increase in the tax revenue for the state fire marshal fund. And it is estimated that the state fire marshal fund will increase by $7.6 million and the general fund will increase by $3.6 million for a total of $11.2 million for the 2003-05 biennium. And I just want to make it clear to you, you know, I think the total amount, you know, is something that is subject to, you know, probably that's probably the most accurate in terms of just what we can, given the assumptions that we have in the model and stuff. But I think the splitting out and what is the portion would be the state fire marshal versus what portion could be the general fund is really subject to, you know, a lot of additional assumptions to get at that particular estimate. So I think because you really are just trying to slice how much could be taken under current law under the corporate income tax system with a credit in place versus when you remove that credit, then how much additional revenue would you be bringing in? And then as you know, portion out what portion of the OIDA assessments would have to also come out of the state fire marshal fund, and that's how you get kind of the slicing between the two. But the overall, if we assume that the OIDA assessments are accurate that we have from DCBS, then that overall impact is really the thing that we can have, you know, pretty strong faith in as far as the overall total change to the state general fund. So some of the key assumptions here with House Bill 3051A is that it has no effect on the retaliatory tax, and I think we've had a couple different legal opinions on that, that they both feel like that's a fine assumption to make, is that House Bill 3051A would not have an effect on the retaliatory tax. Again, it gets back to what's the source of this revenue, and it's not a state revenue source. It's something that's going to, this new assessment would be collected by the insurance companies and kept by the insurance companies, so it's not part of the state tax and fees that would be the overall burden that you're trying to calculate with a retaliatory tax. And then the other key assumptions is basically I was just saying, like, the DCBS forecast of current law OIDA assessments. And this really does have an effect on the total revenue that could be generated from this policy change. And then also the forecast of the fire insurance premium tax under current law. We're roughly at about roughly about $6 million is what is the estimate. And as far as the growth rates in 04 there, you can see the growth rate is roughly 5% on premiums. And in 04 and the outer years, 4% growth in premiums. And then also the most critical thing here really is the growth then in corporate excise taxes under current law. And really, this is the kind of the beginning point is critical of how you're going to what you're going to assume under current law you could actually take of the OIDA assessments under the corporate excise taxes. So in my model, I just looked at the 2001 corporate tax before credits for the property and casualty insurers as the base for the analysis, and then I looked at the the Office of Economic Analysis forecast, the most recent May forecast, but I adjusted those 25% to reflect lower taxable income in this particular industry in recent years. So I looked at the same growth, the change in corporate taxes, but I adjusted it 25% downward in order to reflect this industry's losses in recent years. And then also the gross fire insurance tax that is offset, that is done first, again, by the corporate excise tax. And so everyone's clear, too, that's the gross fire insurance tax that's actually offset. And then what you do is then take the amount of the OIDA assessments that could be offset on the corporate excise tax. And I'm also assuming that 20% of that fire premium tax may not be offset just due to a lack of tax liability by certain insurance companies. Because I have consolidated, I don't have individual insurers in my model. I just have the summarized data. So I know there's some insurance companies that have more losses, and so their tax liability may not even cover all of the fire insurance premiums. So then from there, we need to look at assuming a portion of the OIDA assessments cannot be offset on fire premium tax due to some property and casualty companies that are not paying fire insurance tax in a given year. So basically, this is just important to keep in mind that some OIDA assessments under current law are not recouped. Right? They can't be recouped because they either don't have enough corporate excise tax liability, or they also may not have fire premium tax that they're paying that year. Maybe they didn't issue any new policies dealing with fire premiums. So there are some property and casualty companies that just won't be recouping all their OIDA assessments under current law. What this bill is doing is it's then allowing then through this new assessment on property policymakers that the property and casualty insurance premiums will be allowed, all of it, to be recouped. So this is a bit of a change. And there's also just the issue of the risk that who's absorbing the risk under current law is the general fund. The state fire marshal's office is absorbing the risk of these OIDA assessments. And also the insurance companies are absorbing some of it because some of the OIG assessments under current law don't get recouped. And what we're seeing, if we did nothing at all, we may be seeing even a larger amount of the OIGA assessments that don't get recouped under current law. So what this bill is doing is basically shifting then that risk so that property, you know, the policy holders are the ones who would be, you know, dealing with the risk of how much OIGA assessments were going to be going up. So basically, as far as you have the revenue impact there too. I've pretty well gone through the majority of it, of just the 2003-05 biennium out to the 05-07 biennium. It's roughly $15 million as far as additional revenue in the 2005-07.
Thank you very much. Senator Corcoran missed a little portion or part of that. Could you run through?
Yes, would you repeat that whole thing, please? Listen, anything I can do for the fire marshals and you know all those wonderful people
local governments that are helping me get my little collective bargaining bills passed over in the House. I'm greatly appreciative of.
Mr. Armstrong, thank you very much, Elizabeth. That was very actually helpful to get a complete...
Oh, speak of the devil.
Ken, did you have others that you wanted to bring up, or is it just you?
Senator, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to have others come with me.
Mr. Garrison, do you want to come up also? And
Ryan?
We'll call Mr. Powell after, or do you want to come on up?
Yeah. May I ask Elizabeth some questions?
Yeah, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elizabeth, I was just... I want to clarify a couple things. We are talking about property and casualty that have a fire insurance component. So what are we? Is this homeowners? Is this commercial property?
Senator Ringo, yes, I think it's all of those. And as far as the who is going to have the new premium assessed on them, it's all property and casualty insurance premiums.
All
so it's not just fire.
Is this all. Does this include auto? I mean, I wouldn't think so, but I...
Yeah, I think it does. Yeah.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and North Pacific Insurance Companies. Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, the Property and Casualty Guarantee Association is comprised of all the lines of insurance that would pay an assessment, including workers' compensation. So it is broader than just fire per se. So those companies and those lines of insurance are subject to assessments to pay the claims of insureds whose company became insolvent. Now, What makes this confusing is the fire marshal here, part and now most of the funding, used to get some general fund money, but now most of the funding comes through a fire insurance premium tax, which has really nothing to do with the assessments for the insolvencies. The fire insurance premium tax is applied only to the portion of premium from policies that deal with fire risk. For example, your homeowner's policy, and this is listed in the statutes, five or six lines of insurance, I think your homeowner's policy, 65% of the premium of that policy is subject to the 1% tax that's paid for the fire marshal. In inland marine, part of boating insurance, fire's a covered peril, so maybe it's 10% of that premium is assessed for the fire marshal. So each line of insurance that has a fire insurance component in it pays based on roughly that proportion of the premium that deals with the fire risk. For example, in your homeowner's policy, you have liability coverage and coverages for things that have nothing to do with the peril, fire. So that it's an estimate to try to exclude those portions of your premium. And so, what makes this complicated is that the fire marshal office is then lined up in the offset provision of the guarantee association, so that if carriers are assessed, then over a five-year period, they recoup those assessments through a reduction in their corporate excise tax, and if that's not enough, they can offset against the other direct tax they pay is the fire marshal tax. So what's happened in these times is that the insolvencies that have been coming up in and the assessments been made, most of the property and casualty insurance industry is on its nose, and thus why some of the assessments have to be made is through the insolvencies. So their corporate tax liability is small. So they totally offset that, and now they get the offset against the fire marshal's tax. What this bill attempts to do is to change that mechanism so that it's a direct assessment as opposed to an indirect recovery methodology.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Ringo.
I just want the assessment won't impact auto insurance policies in any way. Am I right?
No. Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, it will affect all property and casualty policies, and the assessment will be a relatively small amount because it will be spread over all of that premium. So it'll be relatively small, but it will affect auto homeowners and workers' comp for that matter.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Do you have an estimate as to the amount of assessment just pick a number. Somebody's paying $500 a year, $750 a year on auto car insurance. But
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, I do not have that estimate. We can try to rough that out for you.
I mean, if you look at the fiscal on it, you could probably get some sense of how many drivers or who they are and what it's raising, give you some sense of the premium that they would see.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I guess I also wanted to ask, and I don't know if Elizabeth is the right person, part of the reason we're doing this is because some insurers have gone out of business after 9/11. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, and again, I feel sorry for your staff because this is like learning how to boil the Atlantic, and the only problem is how to get the wood underneath. This is very convoluted and very complex. And she's done a masterful job of getting her arms around so many different issues. Having said that, I forgot the question.
Part of the explanation for this was that
Mr. Chairman, that was a virtually perfect
9/11. Thank you, Senator Corbin.
I was trying to light the Atlantic while you were saying.
There you go. I think that in the cases of the insolvencies that have come forward, only a very small sliver of that would be directly related to 9/11. And, you know, different insurers got hit at different amounts in that tragedy because of the different situations. But many of the insolvencies are workers' comp companies.
I'm just focusing in on this chart for a minute, though. I don't know if you've seen this. It says $15.3 million in 2001. Mm-hmm. Is that $15.3 million in Oregon?
Yes. That's Oregon's portion.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, what sets that amount is the amount of business that a company who becomes insolvent had in Oregon. So that amount will fluctuate depending on what company goes insolvent. If an insurance company in New England goes under and they're a regional company, it would have no effect on that figure. It would only be for claimants who have claims in Oregon.
John, do you know what companies did go insolvent to cause this $15.3 million charge in Oregon?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, Charlie Nikoloff from the insurance division could list those out one at a time, and they're, you know, I've quite frankly forgotten all the names of the carriers that have become insolvent, but many of them have been workers' comp related.
I see. And the assessments, though, occur because people have paid premiums and now there's no money to pay the benefits, and so we're on the hook.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringel, that is true. And the most states have these forms of guarantee associations, which are set up primarily to protect the person who is driving a car or has their homeowners, because they're not watching what's happening with insurance companies, and so they're, you know, this is all news to them. So it's a systematic way of making sure those claims get covered and the cost of doing that spread over a large base.
Thank you.
So now, if you had 100 ships with red hot logs and you dropped them into the, would that be
that'd be a start.
Ken.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Oregon Volunteer Firefighters, and also Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We've gone way past my preliminary introductory remarks, which I had passed out to you. The one thing I do want to add before, no doubt you've got some additional questions, and no doubt the Fire Marshal, Chief Garrison, wants to offer a few comments as well. The point I want to leave you with is the reason why we brought House Bill 3051 before you, and that reason is that we're facing a situation where the funding for the Fire Marshal's Office, the Fire Insurance Premium Tax, and also for Oregon State Police arson and for Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, most of that was being threatened to go away because of the relationship between the OIGA, Fire Insurance Premium Tax, and the Corporate Excise Tax. What we have done amongst the fire service, and that includes labor and management side of the table, with the insurance industry, with DCBS, with the Fire Marshal's Office, over the last year is say, okay, we've got a problem. How can we fix it? How can we change that mechanism so it doesn't continue to hit the general fund and hit the FIPT? And what we've come up with is what's in House Bill 3051. That it's already been covered. Your staff has covered it very effectively. Mr. Powell has also given you a little bit more detail there. So I think all those issues have been laid out on the table. But I want to leave you with that notion that it's been all the players involved trying to come together and come up with a solution that seems like is going to make the most sense for keeping the doors to the Fire Marshal's Office open, as well as preserve funding for Oregon State Police arson and for DPSST. So with that, I'd certainly make myself available for any questions, and also if you wanted to have some more specific questions of Charlie Nikoloff, he's here in the back of the room and would be able to help field some questions as well.
Okay. Mr. Fire Marshal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Deckard and members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Fire Marshal Robert Garrison. Most of the details of my written testimony have been covered already. I won't bore you with that again, but I would like to touch just briefly on some of the programs that are at risk through loss of funding to the State Fire Marshal's Office and to the other organizations that I'll mention. And I won't go into a great deal of detail on these, but, of course, I'll respond to any questions you might have. State Fire Marshal's Office is charged with collecting and analyzing fire loss data for the state. We do community education programs, working with local fire service partners where there are some. And you should understand that a great deal of Oregon does not have structural fire service. We are the provider of service for community education, as well as for juvenile fire setter intervention programs. We are the source for adopting and enforcing, at least in rural areas, the state's fire code. The state fire code is adopted for the entire state. But in much of the state, if it isn't enforced by a deputy state fire marshal, it isn't enforced. There's no one else to do that. We're also responsible for fire cause determination. Our deputy state fire marshals investigate fires all over the state. We're responsible for mobilizing the structural fire service for responses to conflagrations that are declared by the governor, and loss of these services, loss of this funding would result in our inability to do that. As well as we're responsible for the Governor's Fire Service Policy Council. I serve as Executive Director, and we facilitate the efforts of the Fire Service Policy Council. All of those programs within the Office of State Fire Marshal are at risk here and will in all likelihood be lost in the absence of House Bill 3051A. In addition, fire training and certification through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is funded through what is called the Fire Marshal Tax, the Fire Insurance Premium Tax. And all of the arson investigation and prosecution efforts of the Oregon State Police are funded here. Without this funding, those programs will go away also. And I think it's important to make the point that it is rural Oregon that gets hit the hardest if those programs go away. Your large metropolitan areas like Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford have well-established fire service agencies available, and they, by and large, provide those services other than fire code adoption, which we provide. So the metropolitan areas will be less impacted. The rural areas would be totally impacted by loss of those services. Another point I'd like to make is what Ken Armstrong touched on, that this bill was developed in partnership with the insurance industry. And so we feel very confident that we have their support, and Mr. Powell is here to confirm that for you. I think I'll conclude my comments at that point, other than what's in my written testimony. I thank you for the opportunity to provide the information. I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Thank you. Senator Ringo.
Obviously, you're changing the nature of the program due to several different circumstances, but it seems to me it was originally set up because of the nexus between owning a building and the need for fire protection, and that connection made sense. But we're somewhat breaking that connection, and now is what we're doing is we are assessing drivers of vehicles a certain charge to pay for state fire marshal. Isn't that what's happening here?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ringo, if I might, some of your automobile insurance premium is actually subject to the fire marshal's tax because there is a peril of fire is covered
for the property damage portion of the policy
on your policy. So there is that kind of a connection, and the I guess the direct line nexus is, as you point out, Oregon is such a small state that we cannot assess like they do in California. In California, it's only by line. They can assess by line. So if an auto insurer goes down and becomes insolvent and their claims to be paid, they can just assess automobile insurance premiums and have sufficient funds to pay those claims. In Oregon, our market is too small to do that, so we have to spread it across all lines. And that, I think, it creates the issue that you're correctly raising. But there is just no other way to go about it.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, do you have any problem with us imposing an assessment to pay for school? Only kidding.
Mr. Chairman, could I not respond but say one more thing? there is a statement made in the one document about the fact that insurance, most states impose higher insurance taxes than Oregon, and I wanted to explain how that operates. If you look in the governor's balanced budget document, you will see under the revenue page that insurance taxes are the third largest contributor to the general fund after the corporate excise tax and income tax. And the reason why that statement can be made is in about 1995, we decided in meetings with Governor Kitzhaber that Oregon would do away with the direct premium tax of 2.25%. And rely on the retaliatory tax. And so that $110 million that the state's going to get over the next 2 years in insurance taxes is from the retaliatory tax that was mentioned earlier. And the reason the governor made that decision was the state of Oregon was going to be subject to a lawsuit because of their tax method of favoring domestic insurers. About 95% of all health insurance in Oregon is written by domestic insurers. By adopting, if the premium tax would have been applied to them, it would have been a direct increase in health insurance premium taxes. And that's why this decision was made to have this form of taxation. And my only reason for bringing this up is I did not want the impression to go by that insurers are not paying taxes. They're paying a lot of taxes. In addition to the retaliatory tax, that $110 million. As you know, we have the fire marshal's tax. In addition to that, we're fully assessed to pay for all the regulation at the insurance division, so insurers are assessed for that. If they make profits, then they're also contributors to the corporate excise tax. And then, of course, the payroll from those companies, those people are contributing to the personal income tax. So my point being, I just wanted the committee to be aware that a lot of taxes are being paid.
Thank you. Further questions or discussion? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you want to hear from DCBS or?
No, thank you.
You're good. That's all we've got. Anyone else on House Bill 3051 before we close the public hearing? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3051 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2166. What's that?
Chairman Deckard and committee members. With House Bill 2166, this is dealing with the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. So what this is doing is it adds acquisition costs to the list of eligible costs for farm worker housing corporate excise and personal income tax credit. It adds definitions for acquisition costs, condition of habitat, contributor, farm worker housing, project, owner, rehabilitation, relative, and taxpayer. It specifies that within 6 months of beginning a farm worker housing project, the owner or operator may apply to the Housing and Community Services Department for a letter of credit approval. Then it requires a contributor to also apply for a letter of credit approval. And then it requires Housing and Community Development Services to notify the taxpayer when the application is approved and if the the portion of that credit that is to be claimed by the owner and the portion that would be claimed by an operator of the farm worker housing project and the amount that can be claimed by a contributor. So it's basically just separating out the contributor from the owner or operator. It allows a lending institution that is not subject to taxation to sell or transfer the credit to a taxpayer that is subject to taxation. And it applies to the tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2004. So the main thing to recognize is on the House side, you know, there was a conscientious effort to not make this this bill have any revenue impact in the 0305 biennium. So all the provisions so far that I've just discussed that don't have any revenue impact, they all apply to tax years beginning January 1st, 2004. But what we're also doing in this bill is allowing all of the farm worker housing credit to be sold instead of 80%. But that is going to begin January 1st, 2005. So that's the only component that has any revenue impact, is just allowing a larger portion of the housing credit to be sold. And again, it's because there's quite a few nonprofit organizations that that are in the business of creating affordable housing, and then they are going to want to, since they don't have a tax liability, then they want to be able to sell it. And so they're going to be able to sell 100% of it instead of 80%. So basically, there is no revenue impact in this 03-05 biennium. It just begins in the 05-07 biennium. It's a reduction of $456,525, and then in 07-09 it goes up to $1
million. So thank you.
Ms. Parton, Mr. Schellenberg, and Mr. McCauley.
It's a strange trio.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Deckert, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Parton, and I'm here as the Farm Worker Programs representative from the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. And I appreciate the opportunity to come here this afternoon and speak in favor of House Bill 2166, which would make small but important improvements to the developer portion of the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credits. I want to mention that it passed unanimously in House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. It also passed unanimously in House Revenue. It came through the House floor with only one no vote. I have passed out testimony, and so I won't beat a dead horse, but since this is the Senate Revenue Committee, I thought you might be particularly interested in the bolded phrase on the back, which Elizabeth already alluded to, was no revenue impact in 0305. I would like to provide a little bit of background as to how we got here, a little bit of context since we've had this program for now one full calendar year, and then the explanation of where we're going, although Elizabeth took care of a lot of that. By way of background, in 1999, the legislature established a Farm Worker Housing Interim Task Force, and I would like to acknowledge the good work of Senator Ferrioli as one of the people who was very heavily involved with that. Also, the gentlemen to my left were involved with that, as was Peter Hanley and a number of other people. It was a very diverse group, and a lot of people that didn't always see eye to eye. but they came out with 18 unanimous recommendations. One of them was to send it from Warosha to housing. It more than doubled the size of the credit from $3.3 million to $7.5 million. It increased the percentage of eligible costs that could be claimed from 30% to 50% and clarified that the credits could, in fact, be transferred. Our experience with this program, like I said, we've only had it one full calendar year, but it's unlike any other programs that we've run in the sense that we have awarded credits on projects with total project costs of fewer than $4,000 and greater than $4 million. So you can imagine what a spread that is. We've got some very small rehabilitation on-farm projects, and we've got some very big community-based developments. Just by way of background, a little further on that, 5 out of 12 of the credit awards that we made were, in fact, to nonprofits, and that's why it's so important that we be able to provide this transferability so that we can fully maximize these credits. And then 7 out of 12 of them were on farm of fewer than $75,000 each for those awards. So the bulk in terms of the value was to the community-based development, but the bulk in terms of number of projects were to the small on farm. Elizabeth already ran through the main changes, talking about acquisitions and the grace period and eliminating the ceiling. There were a couple of additional technical amendments added on the House side. One was a definition of taxpayer to make it clear that even though a nonprofit can't claim the credits, they can get them for purposes of being able to transfer them and bring equity to the project. There were also some changes made to clarify who would be responsible for reporting on certain kinds of compliance things. It doesn't make sense to have a bank in Southern Oregon being required to report on things that are not really of their specific knowledge in Milton Freewater. So we wanted to kind of clear some of those things up. I do want to make it clear that I don't work in a big warehouse with a lot of saws and hammers. We work only through partners in the field, and those, again, are in the grower community. They're in the nonprofit housing community. Peter Hanley here represents that. And we see all kinds of different projects with this. They're sorely needed, and we really appreciate our partners and hope that we can maximize the value of the credits and the usefulness of the credits. Please support House Bill 2166. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I'll take the opportunity to thank Ms. Barton for all her work on this issue. She's the technician. I'm kind of the poor cousin here. But it's been a fantastic program. We're here to support the program. I can't really add anything to what she's said, only to emphasize the importance of the program to the agriculture community, that being the farm workers themselves. It's those people that are in need of help, and it's those people that this program really benefits. And we appreciate the support of the legislature in this process. Senator Farioli, again, took a very strong lead in that process. This is simply a continuation of that. What we found as the program progressed was that there was a little more flexibility needed in some of the areas, and those are the three areas that Ms. Barton outlined for you. So, again, Farm Bureau would simply say we support it and would ask that the committee send this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry today. Those are the pear, cherry, and apple growers in Southern Oregon and Jackson County, along the Mid-Columbia, and in Northeastern Oregon in Umatilla County, here today to speak in support of House Bill 2166. I think you've heard most of the positive points about the bill. I'm just going to comment on two parts of the bill and relate their importance to, I think, the producers in the state. The first one being the six-month window during which you can apply for the tax credits. I think it's important to understand the variability in income that comes, at least in the fruit industry, where a crop proceeds may not come in until like 18 months after a crop is sold. A producer may decide that, well, maybe I'll start this project and may dig a trench for a septic, or may lay a foundation and then stop the project, and then the money comes in from the crop that was sold a year and a half ago. all of a sudden can complete the project. This bill recognizes that those things happen in the real world and would allow that person to still apply for the tax credit even though they may have started the project. Also would point out in the Hood River area there are a couple of houses that have been cited that were built at the Snake River Correctional Facility, and this bill clarifies that housing that is acquired can also qualify for the tax credit. So I think those are two real good reasons that this is an important bill for those producers and the farm workers who will reside in these housing, and we support the bill.
Thank you. Senator Hannan.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask a couple questions, and I'm not sure, Ms. Partner, if I'm supposed to ask it of you. The bill, the B and Gross bill, permits a taxpayer eligible to claim farm worker housing tax credit to transfer all of credit to other taxpayer after January 1st, 2005. What is the procedure for transferring the tax credit?
Chair Deckert, Senator Hannan, for the record again, this is Lynn Partner. I'm taking it upon myself to answer the question. The procedure is pretty simple, really, especially compared to some of the other tax credits that we deal with that are also transferable, like the low-income housing tax credit program, which can be kind of a full accountant and attorney employment act. But these are actually, Peter Hanley is really the one who probably arranges for the sales of more of them in the state than anybody else, and so he could speak to the exact process, but it's essentially contractual. But what we do at Housing is we get the appropriate paperwork from them. They cut their own deal, essentially, let us know about it, and then we report the appropriate taxpayer ID numbers to revenue, so revenue is able to match up who is able to take the credits against that appropriate taxpayer ID number so that nobody can just run around and say, oh, yeah, I'm entitled to that without any background identification. And the bill also clarifies that a little bit. It used to talk about apples and oranges a little bit more with regard to people taking the credits under 315.164, which is somebody taking them individually versus taking under 315.169, which is taking them by virtue of a transfer of that sort.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, is there any follow-up procedure by Housing Community Services to verify that the community or the farm worker housing was in fact built and it is habitable and it is maintained and it is a continuation for qualification for receiving tax credit, or is once in the tax credit cradle you're there for as long as it takes?
Chair Decker, Senator Hannan, we're doing a number of things along those lines. The in most cases where you have the individual or the corporation who's asking for the credits actually taking them themselves, and that is the majority of the circumstances that we looked at, as I said, 7 out of 12 in the 2002 calendar year, then revenue has a direct impact. I mean, it's part of their audit process, and so revenue has an ability to look at that. And then we also have some asset and property management things that we are going to be doing. I also want to add, though, we've been in extensive conversations with revenue about making sure that there is accountability here. And in the past, what has happened is there's basically a letter of tax credit approval, which we will still call it because it's a statutory term of art. But typically in the past, that has been just basically a notice, and it goes out to the people who are asking for the credits, and we'll give a courtesy copy to the bank involved, or you know, whoever else the developer indicates, and then the copy to revenue. And that's pretty much just a notice. But what we're going to do, and we've investigated this with the AG's office, and we believe that we're going to be able to do by rule a change where we will actually have that be a contract so that we will have some accountability that we can ask for directly contractually from the developer in addition to the oversight that revenue will have of the person actually taking the tax credit. So we're aware of that issue, and we are moving down the road to make sure that we have that all cleared up, and also we will have asset and property management. There's also, on a lot of these other projects, like I said, the vast bulk of the actual credit award value is going to these nonprofits who transfer. Those huge community-based developments have all kinds of layers of oversight on them. If you have home dollars in there, if you have low-income housing tax credits, those are all on a set schedule of every year or every 2 years or 3 years to have us go out and do a full-bore inspection. Anything that constitutes a labor camp, and it's a very low standard for what constitutes a labor camp, five people or more unrelated in the same place, or OSHA inspects them. So there are layers and layers and layers of things that we are either doing or OSHA is doing or building codes is doing, or and we require a certificate of occupancy or an appropriate inspection from OSHA depending on whether it's on farm and subject to OSHA standards or from building codes depending on whether it's building codes standards. And we don't the credits can't start until the construction is finished. So you can't just say, oh, you know, I'm going to build a doghouse, and then you never do it, but you get credits anyway.
Okay, then the last thing I want to ask is on the eligible cost, is there, under the definition, it has insulation costs and permit costs. What kind of permits? Are these local government permits?
Chair Decker, and Senator Hannan, yes. They would be the usual kinds of construction permits that you would have to get.
So, in other words, one unit of government taxes you, and then you get to turn around and use it as a tax credit for paying a fee. Is that what you're telling me?
Chair Deckert and Senator Hannan, if you consider permit fees to be taxes, I suppose that would be so, but I think those are...
Yeah, well, they really are.
Differentiated in statute.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. In your other housing programs, do you allow tax credits for permit fees?
Chair Deckert, Senator Hannan, I don't want to state definitively that we do, but I'm almost certain that we do. Yes.
So if you have a system development charge or if you have a county building fee or a road assessment or a sewer assessment, those fees would be tax credits?
Chair Deckert and Senator Hannan, I'm going to double-check on this for you, but it is my understanding that normal building construction costs, including permitting, siting, zoning approvals, those kinds of things, I believe architectural fees are things that we cover in our other programs. Now, the other programs, in many cases, I want to say, are under federal statute, like the home program, mm-hmm. the low-income housing tax credit program, some of the other funds that we get are according to federal statute and not state statute. But I can look into which ones include what if you're interested in finding that out.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to add that land costs are not included in this.
I have one concern. I really support the work that Senator Farioli's task force did. I really just don't like, and we have several bills that do this, that begin in 2005, 2007. And I think we have four or five bills that do that. And for me, it's almost a matter of if it's a priority and if it's a good idea, then we should fund it this session. And if there's a fiscal to it, then we should buy it in our overall budget discussions. I don't know if you care to comment.
Chair Decker, we would have been happy to see that, but there weren't the votes in the House Revenue Committee, we believed, to do that, and so that's why we tried to move it out. I really want to emphasize that these are no more credits. We can't give out any more credits than we're giving out. We were oversubscribed for 2002 at more than the double level of what it had been the year before. So we can't give out any more credits than we're already doing. All we can do is make sure they're fully maximized, make sure that they're real and not fiction.
Senator Ferry, I don't know if you have thoughts on that. We're just getting more bills that begin in 2005, and I'm very, I'll just be frank, really hesitant to move anything that starts with 2005 as the implementation date.
Well, given that you only have three committee members, I think I can move anything.
That's just a general.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with the idea that if we are, in fact, doing something that has a good public purpose, we should just do it. I mean, the point is failure to move forward with these kinds of things just sends a message that Oregon was open for business but isn't. So I worry about those kinds of things. And I think the work of the task force was good in any context. So I urge that we support that activity.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I move to amend the bill to make it retroactive to 1991.
So ordered.
No, Mr. Chairman, the appropriate response is without objection. See nobody to object.
Well, so we should
nobody's
get
throwing anything.
Take the 05, 07 out and put it today, and we can put it in our budget negotiations as part of the overall. We'd have to pay for it with other revenues, but
no.
Well, I'd like amendment to at least put that into play.
Senator Deckard is trying to
thank you.
One
thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hanley.
He thinks we're. Are we not going to move this bill today?
No. We're not. We're not free people.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, soon to be member of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm director of CASA of Oregon, and as was stated earlier, we're a private nonprofit based in Newburgh developing farm worker housing around the state. Recently completed projects in Hermiston, the Dalles, and have projects started in Sandy. We'll be starting next month in Medford, and another project in McMinnville, and a couple other on the drawing board in Hood River and other places around the state. As Lynn Partin stated, we are one of the bigger placers of farm worker tax credits, and particularly with with community development corporations. But also, we've done a number of on-farm labor camp rehabs and have assisted individual growers accessing these tax credits. Some of the changes made the last session did the right thing, but these changes that are proposed here will help ensure that these tax credits get used in the most efficient manner. I want to address some of Senator Hannon's comments. The way this works is we go to the federal government for a large majority of the funding, and to get federal government money, we've got to be able to show the leverage. And the tax credits are one of the biggest pieces of that leverage that the state has to offer. So the feds are looking for the state to participate in these deals, and that's how these projects get built is through those cooperative partnerships. One other thing about that Senator Hannon was talking about was the fees and whether or not they're eligible as part of the basis, and they are. And you know, the local jurisdictions have decided to institute those fees, and you know, the credit was decision to set up this credit was made separate and apart from those decisions to assess fees and STCs. So you know, raising taxes or fees on one side and giving them credits on the other, I can't really answer his question probably to his decide how he would like to hear it. So I won't even try.
Sounds good to hear.
I guess at this point, if there's any questions that you have related to this, I think everybody that preceded me pretty much addressed all of the issues. This credit's really important. Oregon has been a leader in farm worker housing thanks to Department of Housing, Community Services, the growers associations that we've worked with, the Farm Bureau. It's these partnerships that have been really important to getting the quality housing that we're able to get done. And without that housing,
agriculture really can't get and attract and retain the grower, the farm workers that they really need. So this is a really important program, and it's been replicated in the state of California with some successes as well. So,
thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Hanley? Thank you very much.
And I just want to add, it was a pleasure working with Senator Ferriola on the task force. Thank you.
Any parting thoughts, Senator Ferriola? This is a bill that came from the task force, I believe.
I just think we ought to support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we will close House Bill 2166 and adjourn the Senate Revenue Committee. Thank you.